Welcome, one and all, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek and our ongoing DC Film Fest. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everyone. Here today to talk Blue Beetle.
Pete, can't wait to dive into this delightful film. First, though, making our way, talking about other pop culture properties here. Star Trek Discovery was at South by Southwest, screened episode 501, had a panel, as they are using this time to really hit the, to get the news out there that season 5 is coming, the final season, etc.
Yes, additionally, the first 4 of the 5th and final season's 10 episodes have screened for press. I've seen the first 4. I really like what they've done. Interesting, Matt. They're out there talking about how it all ends up. First off, it was news to me because Wilson Cruz, who plays Dr. Culber, spoke about it. That though they got to go back and film an ending, because they were told after they had shot, oh yeah, hey, it's the final season. He was unable to be a part of that because he had already taken a job in Taiwan.
I have some gloom and doom things to say about the medium-term future of Star Trek. But I know this. I think it's with, let me this way. We might not love how Discovery episode 510 ends, but I'm looking forward to this season. I'm looking forward not to the end of the Discovery journey, but I'm looking forward to crossing the finish line with Discovery for all that it has brought us in, during its run and so forth. So I'm looking forward to the start of the end of the journey, even though I don't want it to end.
Additionally, they will screen 501 at WonderCon on March 30th. And with that, news about the Star Trek Academy show, one dovetailing into the other, Sonequa Martin-Green of Discovery would not rule out that characters from her show could wind up in the next show, which now, Matt, has a production date.
The buzz, apparently a late summer start. Here's my gloom and doom, Pete. I think that given the potential for Paramount to be sold, I guess, anytime now. Like, it's all weird. It's all through the veil of hush-hush talk and so forth. I think to a certain degree, through the veil of bull feathers, because we've seen Paramount say, oh, we invited the Warner Brothers guy for lunch, and then turn that into 2 weeks of, is Warner Brothers going to buy it? Because it's really valuable. Oh, wait, I think there's all this head game that's being played by Paramount. My concern is this. Paramount Plus is not a profitable streamer. Maybe the most expensive, certainly the most expensive series of shows made for Paramount Plus has been these Star Trek shows. Pete, you tell me people have been cast and people are starting to show up for rehearsals and so forth in Toronto, that's when I will believe that the Academy show is going to be enacted under this leadership team, under this ownership and so forth. Until then, my concern is that it is like the Kelvin movies and that it is just vaporware. Do we have Strange New Worlds in production? Absolutely. Strike delayed and so forth. My worry is we're going to get to the end of that.
We have a movie in production as well. We have the Section 31 film currently lensing in Toronto. But I feel you on that. I've been watching the heck out of the Halo show. This second season, big improvement on the first, and going into this Thursday's finale, that is similarly a question. Will there be more of this show? And if you know anything about the games, they're heading into potentially something really big from the games. They did the Fall of Reach about the midway point of this season, which was easily the best show, best episode the show's ever had, and it's you know, season and almost second now. So yeah, I mean, it's a real issue, this ongoing Paramount saga. I think they've overplayed their hand, as is usual. But Matt, what can you say about you know, that Paramount PR monster?
Pete, I think here's what I would like to prepare us and prepare our listeners for. I'm reminded of Ron Moore's post. I think it was on the Battlestar bulletin boards or something like that. Back in the day, back when Star Trek Enterprise was canceled, he had a post whose title was, you know, Trek goes back to the fans. Essentially this reminder that when Star Trek runs out of Star Trek, it returns to us, even though we don't own it. And I would, you know, and then there's a fallow time and then it comes back again. So I guess I would just say, I feel like let's get ready for that possibility now that there's going to be time away from Star Trek before the next owner tries to do something with it.
In the meantime, Matt, of course, we always have Marvel, and some old is new again. First off, the Agatha show gets a new title, and that connects us with something from another property that's also new again.
Yeah, this was the week when the Agatha show got a new title, and Patty Jenkins was in the Star Wars end working on a Rogue Squadron movie. And it was like, wait, is this 2 years ago? What's going on? I know that kind of there's been the theory that's also been bolstered, I guess, by rumor that the Agatha titles that we've gotten have actually been episode names, or maybe they weren't episode names, but now they are, and kind of this back and forth and back and forth. Look, call the show. It's weird that the most notable thing about the Agatha show right now is the fact that there seems to be slight chaos with its name. But I think we're receptive for that show. A show that probably shouldn't be coming out 4 years after the predecessor series, but that's what happens in a post-COVID, back to work, figure out what's next, this, that, the other, then dual strikes and so forth. Plus, apparently, you can only release it around Halloween because it's so spooky. Pete, I can't wait to watch the show under whatever name they're going to call it.
And then total W, as the kids would say, Matt, for Patty Jenkins returning to Star Wars. You know, much was made on the date in December when her Rogue Squadron movie was set to come out, like, oh, here's what we never got. And with Wonder Woman 3 now officially off the table with the new DCU and James Gunn, that to get her there, you know, we talked Star Trek, Matt, best destinies. Of course, the daughter of a fighter pilot who becomes a director, making a Star Wars Top Gun movie. That's your best destiny, right?
Yes, and I think in the last 5 or 8 years, Star Trek and Star Wars both have discovered, kind of on their own, they've gotten closer to the secret sauce of what people want, which is completely brand new and also totally familiar. I mentioned before the highs and lows of Discovery and so forth. I think for most people, Strange New Worlds is more the show that we want in terms of, Pete, sometimes they say the curse words, or they might talk about, they might include, for example, LGBTQ plus actors or characters. But we also have, you know, flip communicators. Same thing here with Rogue Squadron. Sure, take us into new points in the timeline, whether it's the old, the new, the Rey, the this, the that. Take us to other galaxies in the Ahsoka series and so forth. And before too long, you know, tell us about Rogue Squadron fighting the fight in the familiar fight against the Empire and all of that. So, again, everything, you know, making it completely new and also familiar.
And then that aforementioned DCU, Matt, which we will delve fully into possibly in a moment. But Superman, under Gunn to be shot, being shot entirely in IMAX.
I tend not to bow at the altar of IMAX, in part because I don't know that we have, in part because we don't have great IMAX theaters around here. James Gunn plus Superman plus all shot in IMAX, that might warrant a trip to a proper IMAX location. Full stop. Like, they, you have my attention, James Gunn. You have my attention.
So, Matt, as we talk Blue Beetle here, and though it was not the last released of the, you know, fan-dubbed DC Extended Universe, that belonging to Aquaman 2, which I still have not checked out. Have you?
I have not, no.
Okay. I did watch Flash ahead of our next week discussion. But are you aware that this may, Blue Beetle, be the last of the DC EU or the first of the DCU?
Yeah, and I dig it. I dig it because, you know, having now seen this whole movie, having not a whole lot of affinity to the character, Blue Beetle was a character who was around in the comics when I was a heavy comics reader. Certainly in the Death of Superman arc, Blue Beetle gets put into a coma and it's kind of like, no, like characters in DC are saying, nobody's talking about Ted Kord being in a coma because Superman's dead, and me kind of being like, yeah, I don't really care. Sorry, Ted Kord. But when we get to this movie and we're mentioning him, I'm like, I remember that guy. He was a cool guy. But this movie and this character are not deeply tied to what has come before. This is a super effervescent, fun movie. It's not the greatest comic book movie of all time. It's also better than a number of the movies that we've done for the DC Film Fest. I totally dig the fact that you can take this character, or, you know, with some modification, with no modification, whatever it is, you can port this character over very easily to the new DC universe. I am all for that.
Well, I mean, I think they really know what they have in Zolo Maraduena, and his success breaking through with Cobra Kai, and just how important that could be to building the DCU's future around somebody that young people recognize. And then the way this film was pitched as a hardcore family-focused film, which really comes across, all right, on top of the representation that you give a Latino hero here and how important it was for him to play this character. Everything came together. Was it a super duper success? It wasn't. It made money. Okay. In a year that overall Hollywood and definitely superhero movies were down. Okay. But it's garnered this attention to the point where Gunn knows what he has in Blue Beetle, okay, and Jaime Reyes, and plans moving forward.
Pete, do you know how much press the actors did for this movie?
Unless they filmed some stuff beforehand, like the trick was, probably none, which means it hurt its bottom line even further, right? For a film that made money.
Yeah, this marginally made money, but I would put all the absent profits at the feet of the studio that did not, you know, that put the actors in a position to strike, blah, 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 this and August release. And no, you know, look, I can only imagine, be it in mainstream press, your Jimmy Kimmels and your Colberts and whatnot, let alone, you know, having all these stars going into their own communities and saying, hey, let's get behind this character and so forth, these characters, the vision it presents and so forth. Like, to not do that clearly hurt the film. I was pleasantly surprised most of the time, you know, because we're getting an origin movie here, which, can be easy to watch, but also at times it's like, can we actually get to the thing? No, we need to set up all this stuff. This was a nice origin film. I think it was lusciously directed by Angel Manuel Soto. You know, watch this guy. This guy's headed places as a director. It just kind of came out at the wrong time in terms of the strike, in terms of, I would argue, so late in the summer that like Pete, this would have been a good time at the movies. This is not the greatest movie ever made, but weirdly, with our schedule, podcasting this the week after we did The Batman, which I think is a vastly superior film, but this is like a fun, I would have liked to go to the movies in the summer with you and get popcorn and soda, even though neither you nor I actually, you know, we neither eat nor drink when we go to the movies, but I would have liked to get out of the summer heat and watch this movie. I just didn't know it was a lot of fun, despite the fact that it's not a serious movie.
I was ill prepared for this to traffic so much in things we've gotten in Iron Man movies. That's where it kind of took me out ever so slightly. That core notion about the family is super, super effective and totally grounds this story. But come on, man. You know, we begin with the Cord Industries discovery of the Scarab. You've got Lieutenant Carapax there. This broke-ass Danny Trejo. I mean, how is that actor, you know, Danny Trejo not playing Carapax? Like, did they not meet his quote? Did they not think of him like he completely should have played this role and would have elevated that tenfold? Okay. But then Susan Sarandon gets out of a freaking jet. I had no idea she was in this movie. I mean, it makes sense, Matt. A couple weeks ago, we did her ex with Tim Robbins in, you know, a non-DCEU Green Lantern. What's with this former couple and DC movies with the colors in the title?
Well, it's funny you should mention Green Lantern because, yes, there's an element to this presentation of Blue Beetle where it's, you know, it's an Iron Man suit of sorts, if you will. But there's also that component of like, kind of like use your imagination to make weapons. And every single time Jaime Reyes, along with the suit, right? This is all stuff that we talk about in Green Lantern. The stuff that in Green Lantern, the stuff that Hal dreamed up, it was cinematic to a point, but it kind of didn't capture the spirit of the comics. We got that here in Blue Beetle. We got in Blue Beetle, the suit, what in Green Lantern should have been the ring. We got the thing talking. The thing was a character, an AI, as we might say now. There was an AI with a personality, and there was also the ability to use your imagination, not for, oh, there's a falling thing and make a race car track, which I think did kind of work in Green Lantern, but like, now we're going to turn it into a sonic gun. Now we're going to turn it into swords. Now we're going to, like, this was doing a better Green Lantern than the Green Lantern movie that we watched. And I don't think that, I don't know. I just found that delightful that we got Green Lantern and we got the Iron Man suit kind of together. You know, again, both reflective of the comics and who cares how derivative it is to a certain point, but like it did it better than Green Lantern.
And playing not Dr. Sanchez there, Harvey Guillen, he of course of What We Do in the Shadows, really great. And that there's an in joke later on, De La Cruz, of course, a reference to his character on that show.
Even the presence of George Lopez, who one of the times I've done the touristy tour of Warner Brothers Studios, I saw George Lopez on a bicycle, and he kind of gave a wave as he kind of did a lazy turn away from the tour group. He was great in this too. It's probably because somebody wrote the lines for him. Pete, if you haven't heard, George Lopez apparently steals jokes from other comics. He was great here. He was funny. I thought initially that it was like, oh, we're cutting to just close-ups of him because maybe he's not in it that much and they're he was filmed separately and so forth. No, he's just a good old presence. He is a full supporting actor in this effort here as Rudy Reyes, and a ton of fun.
The guy in the chair, right? I mean,
yeah.
The movie traffics in tropes. But like I said before, that family element really selling it. So here we are with Gotham City Law graduate Jaime, leaving Cobra Kai, returning to Palmera City, apparently what Miami is in the DC universe, and that his family has conspired to withhold against him, that they're losing their home, the family business, and that the patriarch has had a heart attack as they try to navigate life in the barrio of Edge Keys.
And you know what? If you're going to make me eat my story vegetables and sit and say, because this is launching a character, we need to do a ton of exposition, then you know what? Sit me down at the table along with the family as they do and sit and go, we have a bunch of things to tell you. Mom's going to now talk. Wait, what? Dad's going to now talk. Wait, what? Sister's going to now talk. Wait, what? Uncle's now going to talk. Wait, what? Okay, are you now clear on everything? Because we just fed you all the catch me up that you need. You good to go? Because now we're going to leap out of this table moving on. We're not going to spend five scenes going, oh, did you hear about Dad's heart attack? No. We get it all in that scene. It's almost too much. But you know what? Story vegetables are story vegetables. We got it. We did stuff with them.
There's two pinch points in this film I'm going to talk about that aren't handled really well. The first being the transition now to, oh, all right, we've gotten the bad news, so let's make it look like they live in a nice place. Oh, no, they work there because the sister, Milagro, has gotten her brother a job cleaning the hotel. All right. And oh, they just happened to run into Cord Industries magnate Victoria Cord having a fight with her niece over her father's legacy. And I mean, these are the uncomfortable story vegetables of, all right, and here's, we're going to make you watch a video about the OMAC, the One Man Army Corps, that then has the chivalrous Jaime standing up for Jenny. I'll get you a job. This was a little overly contrived and convenient.
Agreed. It would have been nice, and I understand that the One Man Army Corps has comic origins and so forth. Let's just call it RoboCop, can't we? That's essentially what it is.
Ed's 209.
Yeah.
210, 211.
Pete, I agree with all your criticisms. All I will say is I suspect that maybe the production was aware, and the production was like, you know, again, we're just going to chug through this to get the story going and to not spend 45 minutes of, you know, and then he goes to take her up on the job. We're just going to move. This is a movie that was made for about $115 million. So I don't think there was a lot of standing around and like, let's shoot a bunch of scenes that maybe we're going to use. Like, it's the opposite of the Marvel end where you shoot something for $275 million and then go, you know what? Actually, like a third of it, I don't want to use. Let's go make another third of a movie to make the movie that we actually want to. This is just on the move there. And before you know it, he's getting dropped off by the entire family to a slightly ridiculous point where they're cheering him on. This is a movie that's existing in a world that is a hair ridiculous at times. And on this collision course to get the burger box that has the scarab.
Yes, that Jenny is secreting out of her family's company under the nose of not Dr. Sanchez there. And I can buy this, you know, oh yeah, I forgot about the job I owe you because I have to steal this thing that is key to my father's legacy and the company and all that. So I'll forgive that one. The worst is still to come. Of course, he's told not to look in the burger box, which his family and, again, why it works, influences him to do. And as we mentioned before, this really kind of broke-ass Iron Man suit alien version crawls up his behind, Matt, with your girl, Becky G, voicing Kaji Da.
Pete, I'm a youthful person. I know Becky G from all the things that she's done. She of a combination of hip-hop, R&B, reggaeton, you know. But
your jam from the Flamin' Hot Cheeto movie that was up for Oscar.
Oh, was that...
Yes, I didn't know who this lady was until the Oscars. I'm like, okay, so, Becky G, not related to Kenny. All right, cool. Whatever.
So you're saying that in our timeline, twice in the last week, we've gotten Becky G. Pete, I think the universe is saying, check out when I walk the dog later tonight, time to check out some Becky G on Spotify.
Well, she voices this this AI, okay, and we get the choosing of Jaime, right? That he flies around, that he checks out the suit, or rather the suit checks him out, to the next day, waking up and, all right, I gotta go find Jenny, and just happens to find her being shot at by cord thugs.
Again, it's a movie that wears its conveniences on its sleeve. I could only view the first third of this movie through the lens of our, of this DC Film Fest. This is not a better movie by any stretch of the imagination. This is not a better movie than Superman the movie or Batman 1989. But Superman the movie takes forever for us to get Superman in a suit. Okay, Batman 1989 gets us Batman in a suit right away and then works in the origin story there. So again, those are kind of two extremes. And I feel like maybe Blue Beetle as a production is being mindful to just get to guy in suit doing exciting suit things sooner than not. Even though we're still at the phase of the learning curve and it's going to reboot at various points. It's going to still get to know his personality, blah, blah, blah.
What this sequence serves to do, to have Jenny introduced to the family, to realize obviously what she does not have because of the loss of her father and her estrangement from her aunt. And then this mission to steal another thing. We gotta go back while they're having some big military party where people are wearing all white, that we gotta steal a watch that my dad had, which leads to this first throwdown between Carapax and Jaime, where Jaime is instructing the suit not to kill him.
It's character development through action. It's showing his personality through action. I was a bit put off by Carapax's, you know, robo suit here, to a point that was very pinky up, like, I can't believe how terrible this design is. Okay, later in the movie, when you see a, you know, phase two design, I think that was, you know, thus on purpose to just have a very phase one design there. It all works. And again, I'd like to say, you know, through the lens of Green Lantern a couple weeks ago, good job here having a suit which is sentient. I have to confess, Pete, I don't know if that's the case in the comics, although I feel like it makes so much sense to have the suit be some kind of character that you can talk to have a dialogue, to share your interior thoughts and all of that. So it's a retroactive finger wag again to Green Lantern that chose not to do that with the ring.
The newer incarnation of Blue Beetle is, and what we see when Jenny takes Jaime and Rudy to her home, that the OG Blue Beetle, her father, Ted Kord, was active in the 80s, that, all right, whereas Batman, you know, in Gotham, also a billionaire. But Rudy explains he had more of a sense of humor and, you know, bathing everything here in the blue neon, and that later we're using things like the Nintendo Power Glove to, you know, put abilities in people's hands, you know, the arcade stand-up machines and everything like that. You know, it is visually interesting to look at, whereas, you know, every Batcave is essentially the same Batcave.
Add to it again, you know, my affinity for Blue Beetle from the comics, yeah, I don't have much, but it was like, there is the comics accurate suit. By the way, Pete, Ted Kord, actually the second Blue Beetle, there was one.
Yes,
from like the,
Garrett was the one before, yeah.
And I have to confess, A, I didn't know that until after watching this movie. I thought that Ted Kord, the guy, you know, the guy in the 90s comics, I thought he was it.
There's another comic subsidiary before DC.
Yes, Charlton, which, by the way, Pete, we'll fast forward a little bit here. Did you think that the, what was the name of the Blue Beetle ship?
The Bug Ship.
Did you think that it looked a lot like the Owl Ship from Watchmen?
Just a little bit.
Do you know why that is?
Is it the same thing?
Well, Alan Moore wanted to use Charlton characters in his initial idea for Watchmen. And because I think Charlton, it was around that time, I think, when the Charlton characters were sold to DC. Or maybe DC had owned them for a while, but that was when there was going to be Crisis on the Infinite Earths, and the Charlton characters were going to be brought over properly. And so DC was like, no, 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 don't turn the Charlton characters into, like, this one is a overweight loser who can't perform in the bedroom. This one kills people. This one is naked all the time. Make your own characters. So the reason the Bug Ship and the Owl Ship look similar is because for as much as Night Owl 1 and 2 are similar to Batman, they're based on Blue Beetle 1 and Blue Beetle 2.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And that does come across in the presentation. I was wondering if you were going to tell me, oh yeah, it's the same exact rig they used. the Warner Brothers kept it in the family there. But the idea advanced here, remember, we're dealing with both an alien, you know, parasite that chooses a host, and a suit that, though it's protecting him, it's moving towards symbiosis, and the only way it's ever going to leave him is going to be upon the condition of not being alive, that the family is attacked, because, of course, the choppers have to go in a route directly over the place where Blue Beetle is at the time.
Keeping the family front and center with the conflict and so forth. Again, it did seem a little convenient. And anytime I started to think about maybe rolling my eyes over that, I was like, you know what? Susan Sarandon's Kord helicopter, that's not a helicopter, is really cool. And it's great to look at. And I'm glad I can see all the details. Unlike the superior film, The Batman, I can see many of the details because they're lit up or they're self-lit. No, I'm not asking
even
for neon.
Even at night, they're lit up.
Yeah, I'm not asking for neon on the Batmobile in The Batman Part 2, but I could see she things at night. So this movie is aware of the fun it's having. I think in a little bit, we're both going to talk about the most ridiculous Deus Ex Machina in the entire film, which also was one of the most delightful moments. It knows what it is, and it knows that we're there to have fun. And when in doubt, you know, when in doubt, turn on the drama, turn on the fun, even the drama here that results in the loss of the father. It's a compelling moment.
We see it coming. They've laid the story tracks for it. We care about this family. And again, though the contrived overconvenience of, oh, he knows they're going exactly for his family because suit and whatnot, that he gets wrapped up, that he can't prevent it, leaving the family without him, leaving the family without its patriarch. And Matt, if we could only turn to what eventually will become a Gatling gun wielding former revolutionary grandma who rallies the family unit.
And that's, I mean, I was laughing out loud at it. I think within the world of the movie, it 1000% makes sense. If you want to be a curmudgeon and say, well, she isn't, this in no way is set up, unlike, say, the loss of the dad. This isn't set up that she's got a history and whatnot. Pete, again, I would err on the side of, it's like a life lesson. Like, all those olds, they have potential that you're maybe overlooking, and so forth. If it is truly just a deus ex machina moment, you have fun with it. It's a guy in a alien, you know, bug suit that does stuff, and like, we are here to have fun. Fun is okay. And, you know, I thought it was just a great moment. It was an absolutely great moment.
Taken away to an island just off the coast of Cuba there, Jaime's in trouble, and the family has to come rescue him. Cue the aforementioned Nintendo Power Glove that Milagro gets to wield. And then the fun of the ship doesn't just fly, it also crawls, and it bug farts.
Yeah, again, it's, you know, it's hammering home what we've discussed so far, keeping the family as part of the story, you know, key part of the story here. Again, Pete, shades different from last week's entry, The Batman, where you had pointed out, yeah, Alfred, the de facto dad, he's shown in the hospital as not dead and not doing great. And then the movie does not return to him for the rest of the movie. Okay, here, we're just reiterating family, 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 the fun of the ship. And it's at about this point where we get the evolution of Carapax's suit into a better looking threat than version one.
Mega Carapax really kind of reminded me of Maximilian from Disney's The Black Hole a little bit. That or the visor, the not quite T-shaped, more Y-shaped visor, a little bit like Samus Aran from the Nintendo series Metroid. But with Jaime here, pushed into what seems like the netherworld, like don't go into the light kind of stuff. And dad being there, actively part of the story that, hey, you need to reach out for Kajada. You need to become one there. It's not your time yet. And great to get a little bit more of the dad than we thought we would, to something that culminates in a fun beat 'em up sequence with tremendous use of Cypress Hills Ain't Going Out Like That.
I also appreciate, because it's around this time when we get the sad backstory for Carapax, so too do we have sprinkled throughout the not as sad, but the sad backstory of Victoria Cord, the Susan Sarandon character, just kind of understanding her perspective. Look, she could have just glee. It could have been, we get, you know, notable Oscar winner and star to be in this movie with a bunch of actors that many people have not necessarily seen before. Go out there and just be gleeful villain, you know, be the industrial weapon maker and say a lot of lines like, you know, it's for a better tomorrow, now kill them, you know. Instead, to get this idea that Victoria Cord has been passed over because she's a woman and so forth, did it make me more sympathetic to her? No, not really. She's clearly the villain. But I appreciated, you know, turning her into a 3D character.
And with that story of what had happened with Carapax in Guatemala with the death of his mom, the explanation of the locket, all of that for, you know, him to have that motivation fleshed out as well. And for Jaime to, you know, almost go too far, right? And to have Kajada pull him back. Hey, we're not killers. We don't do this. But Carapax a killer, and he's going to kill Victoria Cord.
It was a nice twist on the idea of a symbiosis here, because it's so it's made so very clear, you know, it's going to be a symbiosis until you die, until you, like, all the negativity of having a meeting point between Jaime and the suit, that is hammered home. But here it is at the end. Kajida is the one pulling him back from killing and all this. It's a nice moment. The threats end up neutralizing each other. As you said, Pete, giving the family time to mourn, and also giving us the beginning of the happy ending where Jenny is the new CEO. They're not going to make weapons anymore. Pete, if you can imagine a company that used to make weapons no longer making weapons in a comic book franchise. Pete, they're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, thank goodness she didn't stop at Burger King. And then the family, fresh from their father's funeral here, coming back to the home that Jenny's going to help them out with. And also the community of Edge Keys has jumped in with both feet to help them with. And again, underscoring not just the family you have, but the family that chooses you. Until Matt, in a mid-credit scene that now I know may have some portent, probably will have some portent, Ted Kord is alive.
Good news. I made me happy to hear that. I also think it...
Who do you cast?
I don't know. And I think that
I'm going to tell you right now who I want, who's at the top of my list.
Okay? Tell me, Pete. Tell me.
Tell me it can't happen. But get me Edward James Olmos. Okay. You had him in Miami Vice. Why can't you get him in this?
There's no reason why you can't. I think that's a great choice. And also, dramatically, it gives, if that's a route you're going to go in the future, it gives Jenny kind of continued purpose in the next story. It also gives, you know, the character of Ted can be the mentor. Pete could be a father figure to Jaime Reyes. Like, it just all works in a movie whose pieces all work together to make a movie that works. It's not groundbreaking, particularly groundbreaking visually or cinematically. It's not particularly groundbreaking when it comes to a hero's journey or a comic book hero's origin or things like that. It's a good old-fashioned time at the movies, albeit courtesy of our couches on HBO Max. What's the stat here that's like the biggest it was like the biggest streaming movie in the history of Max or something like that? Here it is. Became the most streamed film on Max. The way that's worded, Pete, that might mean just Max, not HBO Max. The way Paramount Plus says it's a brand new service from a couple years ago and completely ignores the fact that they just renamed CBS All Access. But I'll take that as a star next to the name of Blue Beetle, the most streamed film on the history of Max. That's awesome.
That's a feather. And again, with what Zolo has done between Cobra Kai, between this, I gotta think he will return to that Cobra Kai universe after its final season. I just think there's too much popularity with that core of characters, even though they're moving. I don't know if you saw, Matt, Ming-Na Wen has been cast in the film they're doing.
I did see that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, I was already interested because I've gotten sucked into Cobra Kai, but now, you know, I'm there. But yeah, I think he's got a tremendously bright future. This was a great gig for him. It's clearly one that is important for the universe going forward. You know, interested to see, you know, will he interact with their Superman, with their other characters? You know, the Blue Beetle now has a very close association with Booster Gold, you know, when, if they do that. But yeah, this was fresh. This was vibrant, a little cliched in some places, but again, I care about this family and I want to see them again.
And I feel like Zolo is a young enough actor, you know, early 20s, where like to sit and say, all right, we're going to pull you off the bench it's going to be TV footage that will appear in the Penguin series. They're going to watch a little thing like that's all you're going to do this year with the character. Okay, cool. Go do other things. It's not like, you know, it's not like he's being left by the side of the road if they don't immediately do more Blue Beetle stuff. But yeah, this will be a great character to return to when the larger DC universe calls for it. With that, Pete, let's take a look at Twitter, where people were able to offer their thoughts about Blue Beetle. For the lowest rung, one yikes emoji, number nine, got 6.7%. For two, applause, a day in the life, 26.7%. For three, thumbs up, sure is something, got 20%. See what I did, Pete? I did a Beatles theme here, even though it's not that Blue Beetle. And then four check marks, twist and shout, 46.7%. So, Pete, of the many people, okay, not a ton, but of the people voted, you know, 66% gave it, you know, a three or a four. That's my takeaway. Some comments here on Twitter from Major Noel Gardner at Noel Camille. I just watched this one a few days ago. I was pleasantly surprised. It really got hampered by the strikes and coming out after the DCU announcement. Way better than Aquaman 2. Ooh, shots fired, Pete. Shots fired.
Yeah, it does not pump me up to watch that, but wasn't expecting anything there. And, you know, the two I have not seen now to this point are that one, and I have not finished Shazam 2. I don't know if I even should.
We hear next from Steve Thurbridge, who says it was a fun movie. It was severely hampered by its release amid the James Gunn Snyder kerfuffle and restructuring. Was it great? No. Was it worthy of my time and a bucket of popcorn? Yes. Which is why it came out in August. I don't know why they knew what they were doing, strike notwithstanding. They knew what they were doing, and still Warner Brothers shot itself in the foot. Next, Spider-Ham Lincoln at TessLC139. I've yet to see Blue Beetle. May never. Anyone here able to convince me that's worth a view? I'm just not as interested in the DCEU. I also haven't seen Shazam 2, Aquaman 2, Ezra's Flash, Joaquin's Joker, or Birds of Prey. Wonder Woman 84 was bad. Black Adam was just okay. Meh. I'll say this. Joaquin's Joker, I think, is worth seeing. It is a very, very well-made movie. I don't particularly agree with some of the perspective that it brings, but it is a film. And Birds of Prey is a ton of fun for R-rated. It's the last movie, Pete, you and I saw it together before COVID hit. Birds of Prey, everyone should see. Birds of Prey is a ton of fun.
Enjoyed the heck out of it. And I really kind of liked Black Adam really won me over. But I think I like this a little bit more.
Court, that's at Jen Deve, D-E-V-E, said, I had a lot of fun with it. I enjoyed the cast very much and even the story. I knew it didn't stand a chance, but I wanted to see what would happen next in the world. Last tweet, Pete, comes from Ben Larson. That's at Larson Ben. I think if DC had made more movies like Blue Beetle, they would have been more successful. Likeable lead, fun side characters, and a fun story. It's just a shame it came out after most people had pretty much given up on DC movies.
Well, yeah. James Gunn hasn't, so and he knows what he has here. So, yeah, look forward to the MCU-ification of DC, and know that they've got a 22-year-old leading man who is very popular with young people to build around.
Pete, this outing has been made possible by those who support us on patreon.com/fantasticgeek, and our ongoing thanks to all who keep us listener-supported.
Yes, everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive content, all sorts of levels to choose from, but it takes just $1 a month to get you in there. You put the price on the content. After that, can't contribute this month, get yourself over to Apple Podcasts. You can leave us a rating or review and help us just as much.
Pete, let's keep the pop culture conversation going, particularly as we look towards wrapping at least this first outing of the DC Film Fest, next week's film. The Flash. How can people be in touch with you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Threads. You can find me on Blue Sky at Peter, PIETERJKELAR, KETELAAR, 12,600 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on fantasticgeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, and Threads. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/fantasticgeek with a PH, all one word, like it today.
Back next week for Flash, which I have yet to see. It'll be an interesting, final trip for us, I think, to the DCEU. For now, though, Pete, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you the final word.
Talk to you soon.